Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last February, 20,000 teachers and staffers in West Virginia went on strike, shutting down schools in all 55 counties. Massive news coverage followed those strikes, and they took off like a wave. Strikes took place in Oklahoma, Arizona, Kentucky, North Carolina, and cities like Denver, Chicago, and Los Angeles, just to name a few. In January, 30,000 teachers went on strike in Los Angeles for a record 6 days. The LA Unified School District serves 640,000 students. It's the second largest school district in the country, and it was the first teacher strike in LA since 1989. These strikes have had a major impact. Many teachers saw salary increases, limits on class sizes, and schools increased their staff of nurses, counselors, and librarians. And for many of us, we had no idea the number of counselors, nurses, and librarians was so low to begin with. Many teachers argue that their union's requests were not entirely met. So on today's Your Call, as educators plan to go back to school soon, we're going to talk about where this strike wave is today, where it's going, and then the larger question, how have these strikes affected the overall labor movement? Today, we are joined by three guests. Eric Blanc is a former high school teacher in the Bay Area who now writes about labor movements and teacher strikes. He is the author of Red State Revolt, The Teacher Strike Wave and Working Class Politics. Eric interviewed over 100 teachers for his book. Hi, Eric. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you. Joseph Glatzer teaches 7th grade history at Pinole Middle School in the West Contra Costa Unified School District. That's in Northern California. He's been teaching there for 3 years and has taught in the Bay Area for 4 years. Joseph is a union rep at Pinole Middle School and is a member of the United Teachers of Richmond. Hi, Joseph. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And we're joined by Erica Alvarez, a Latinx activist and English and language arts teacher at Legacy Visual and Performing Arts High School in Southgate, California, in Los Angeles. Erica also teaches yearbook and journalism classes, and she serves as chair of the Education Committee for the Democratic Socialists of America. Hi, Erica. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. Well, I want to start off with a very basic question for all of you, because as you know, the news just travels so fast now, it's easy to forget what happened just a couple of days ago. So can you just remind us how massive these strikes were? I mean, we all remember the 20,000 teachers and staffers in West Virginia who went on strike, shutting down schools in all 55 counties, which was incredible to see. And this really took off like a wave. So, Eric, can you just remind us how big this movement has become?
Yeah, the reality is we're in the first strike wave in 4 decades in the United States, which is a big deal on its own. And just in 2018 alone, there were almost 400,000 educators, which is not just teachers, but other workers that work in the school, went out on strike. And that's the highest number in the history of the United States. So this is really unprecedented. It started in West Virginia, spread, as you mentioned, to Oklahoma, Arizona. Now it's in the blue states. And it's brought back the strike to the labor movement as a whole. And it's really brought back the crisis of education to the fore. And now we're changed the narrative. So it's no longer teachers being blamed, but underfunding, segregation, and just the kind of corporate offensive against schools and unions.
I think that is such an important point, because every time we do shows about these strikes, I think back to the time when the conversation was about so-called reform, and there was so much blame on teachers. And the media tended to talk to these corporate reformers without giving a voice to teachers, and that has been completely flipped on its head.
Yeah, it's a game changer. You know, you're talking about polls nationally, about 76% of polled citizens support the teacher strikes and their demands, and a similar amount in states like Arizona or Oklahoma, which are hardly liberal, let alone radical bastions. So I think really we've won the public narrative. The question is now, how do we force the politicians to actually meet our demands, because that remains to be done.
Right. And we will definitely talk about that throughout the show. That is Eric Blanc. He's a former high school teacher in the Bay Area and author of the book Red State Revolt, The Teacher Strike Wave and Working Class Politics. Joseph, you teach seventh grade at Pinole Middle School in West Contra Costa, the unified school district there, which is in Northern California. As a teacher, can you talk about what these strikes mean to you, and what went through your mind when you saw this wave take off from West Virginia?
Well, for me, it meant hope. It meant that hope that things are finally changing, that the narrative is changing, and I agree with everything Eric said. And, you know, our district didn't personally go on strike because we've had a pretty good collaborative relationship with our school board, but at the same, because we got about 15.5% over, I think, 3.5 years, something like that. And so we were one of the lucky ones in terms of our action that we took was really effective. But when we're looking at other districts, I mean, I think the opening offer for Oakland was like 1% over 2 years or something just totally crazy like that. And that's not to mention the other issues, which are charter schools and the corporate onslaught, which we were talking about a little earlier. And so I think that's the one that's really hitting us in my district. But even that has also taken a step back in terms of our district, along with Los Angeles Unified and Oakland Unified, have passed those resolutions asking for the state to do a moratorium on charter schools. And so we can see at the school board meetings, you know, for the first time since I've been teaching in this district, that the public school supporters are actually outnumbering the charter school people at the school board meetings. So things are definitely changing.
Wow. And maybe we can get into this later, but since you mentioned that you have a good relationship with your school board, and so you didn't have to go on strike, can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think on most of these school boards, you have this split between the pro-charter and the anti-charter. That's like kind of the main split on most of these school boards. And a lot of them are also not really in favor of funding public education the way it needs to be. But I think even sort of the pro-charter members of our school board, or those that are kind of in the middle, are pretty much unanimous in terms of wanting to support higher salaries for educators and things like that. So, you know, that's pretty good for our, in our respect. But at the same time, there's only so much they can do because, you know, our district is losing $27.9 million to charter schools every year, and that's going to pay for a lot of counselors, psychologists, smaller class sizes. And I'm sure we'll get into more of these class size topics later, but, you know, my class size last year, the maximum was 38, and in PE it was 55. And next year we're able to go down by one. But, I mean, these numbers are actually obscene.
You also understand there's a lack of substitute teachers at your school, and this is still an unmet need?
Yeah, that's right. And this is something that people don't really talk about or know that much about. For example, in many school districts in Canada, the substitute teachers are part of the actual teachers union. They don't have their own union or anything, but they're part of the same union. And so the union has more of an incentive to sort of bargain on their behalf as well. And so what happens is when we have a shortage of substitute teachers, teachers have to end up subbing during their prep periods, which means instead of teaching five classes, we have to teach six classes that day. Now, we get paid a little extra, but in the end, it's really not worth it because that's less time that we have to even meet with students, to go to parent meetings, you know, to do our lesson planning, to do grading. So that means we have to get to school earlier and stay later.
And that is Joseph Glatzer. He teaches seventh grade history at Pinole Middle School in the West Contra Costa Unified School District. We're also joined by Erica Alvarez, a English and language arts teacher at Legacy Visual and Performing Arts High School in Southgate, California, in Los Angeles. And Erica, before we talk about the massive strikes that happened in Los Angeles, what was going through your mind when you saw what the West Virginia strike and the wave that took off from there?
I knew it was only a matter of time. We actually had an interesting makeup on our school board. It was very pro-charter. That's not the case anymore because we had the election of Jackie Goldberg. I actually ran in that election, and I left it so that I wouldn't split the public school vote. We knew that it was going to happen. It's been 4 years in the making for Los Angeles, and our union leaders definitely mimicked a lot of the grassroots movements that they saw in the other states. We wore red on Tuesdays. We held signs. We went to all of the meetings. we weren't very much prepared for what would eventually happen. And then that's why our union got a 97% strike authorization vote from all these teachers, because it was already being talked about at all of these meetings.
So let's just talk about the historic strikes that went on in Los Angeles. In January, you went on strike with the United Teachers of LA for a record 6 days, and 98% of LA teachers voted in favor of the strike. Talk about just what it was like to be part of that for 6 days, Erica. It got so much media attention. And, you know, one of the facts that really stood out for me, and we talked about this on the show when that strike was happening, is that LA Unified in Los Angeles identified over 17,000 homeless students as of April 9th. And that was a really big part of the conversation you were all having.
It definitely was. It was a total social justice issue. We didn't cut it up to, you know, this is like educators wanting a raise. That was part of a very long list of demands that we had. So we wanted full-time psychiatric social workers. We wanted full-time nurses. We wanted full community school amenities that were needed for people that are homeless and children that are facing those difficulties. And so when we went out there and we were striking, it was just about the kids, and it was always about the kids. So 6 days in the rain for Los Angeles people, you can imagine what that felt like.
Yeah.
I totally was not prepared. But I also come from like two generations of union folks. And so I got the calls. I got the love on the line. People were bringing us lunch. We had parents joining us. We had students joining us. They all knew why we were on strike. We had passed out these sheets before stating the facts and stating why charter schools were privatizing our district. So the students really didn't have a problem with it. The parents didn't have a problem with it. The numbers dwindled, and LAUSD had lost millions of dollars in revenue as a result of this strike. And I think that's when we were able to definitely levy some power there and make sure that all of these things were supported. So after the strike, our class sizes went down. We lowered the amount or the regularity of standardized testing. It led to the stop of that racist practice of random searches at schools, or supposedly random searches at schools. It just really catapulted us to a new bargaining power with LAUSD.
Wow. So these, I mean, these are major changes, small class sizes. What about the demands for full-time nurses and more counselors, especially when you're talking about so many kids living in poverty and so many kids who are homeless?
Yes. So now we're entering the new year, and we'll have a full-time nurse on campus. The only thing that we weren't able to get was that full-time psychiatric social worker that we wanted. And we're still fighting for that. And now, you know, the makeup of our board has definitely changed, and it's, you know, addressing those needs and those issues. There's a whole housing and homelessness unit that existed within LAUSD before. Now they're looking at more creative ways at addressing those issues, and we definitely demanded the funding of the state of California. Gavin Newsom sent over millions of dollars so that we could resolve this strike, and it's definitely being allocated in the right ways, because, again, like, a strike wakes up activism. It calls activism. It, you know, captures the imagination of potential activists and our parents. So we've seen an upsurge in parents just going to those school board meetings and demanding that, you know, these things be addressed, like homelessness, like, you know, the psychiatric care needed to address trauma in that sense, right? And so I think, like I said, it's the strike was the jumping off point, and it's leading to all of the potential we wanted it to lead to.
That is Erica Alvarez. She teaches English and language arts at Legacy Visual and Performing Arts High School in Southgate, California, in Los Angeles, describing what happened when she and so many teachers and educators went on strike for 6 days in Los Angeles, and the major changes that she saw as a result. We're also joined today by Eric Blanc, who's the author of Red State Revolt, The Teacher's Strike Wave, and Working Class Politics. Erica brought up so many interesting points here. Can we first talk about the social justice aspects of this strike? Because I think it really educated the larger public about not only the fact that teachers have to buy their own school supplies and that many teachers across the country have an additional one or two jobs, but also just what happens in the classroom, that so many kids in a very wealthy state like California, for example, are in poverty. I remember when the West Virginia strike happened and a lot of people said, yeah, that's a red state. Look at how bad it is there. And then these strikes happen in California. And we said, well, hey, this is the fifth largest economy in the world. And yet look at all this, the poverty in the school. So can you talk about the social justice aspect of this and the stories that educators were able to tell and the educating that went on around these strikes? Do we have Eric? Did we lose?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Hi.
Sorry. So when the strikes started, as you mentioned, the discourse was, this is just a red state thing. It's just about pay. And what that missed, even in the red states, it was never just about pay. You know, the main demands in a place like Oklahoma and Arizona were around funding for students. And so part of the success of all of the strikes, not just LA, but definitely including LA, is that these unions and the rank and file that have driven forward the movement weren't just fighting for themselves, but they were fighting for really working people as a whole in the community and parents and students. Mm-hmm. And that was clear. And that's so important because one of the reasons why unions have been in decline is that the right wing has been able to paint our side as sort of being narrowly interested in just, you know, fighting for ourselves, and unions are just another special interest. And so the way that these strikes broke out of that was by being extremely proactive in fighting for the needs of the community as a whole. So, as you mentioned, in a place like LA, not only were the demands on behalf of parents and students, but like in all of the states, there was a tremendous amount of organizing, really years of organizing with parents and students ahead of time. You know, I was able to witness some really amazing community meetings months before the strike, in which it was just union organizers and teachers were there listening to parents and asking them, you know, what is your need? What do you think the school should look like? What can we do to help? And it was that kind of real deep organizing, not just in the school sites, but in the community as a whole, that was able to bridge some of these divides. So in a place like Arizona, similarly, you know, when I thought about Arizona before the strikes, I think about all of the anti-immigrant sentiment, things like Arpaio and this real kind of racist, you know, divide. But the union and the movement was able to bridge that by saying, look, we have common interests. We need to fight for more funding, not just for parents, but for students. And it was amazing. You had students walking out for their own demands in all of these states, right? Students took the lead. And I think that's one of the really remarkable aspects of these strikes, is it wasn't just teachers who went on strike, but you had student leaders really reject this corporate narrative, particularly students of color, because a lot of the corporate offensive against schools has been nominally done for working class students of color. You know, that's why we need to bring in choice, presumably so-called choice, because it's failing black and brown students. But you had black and brown students walking out and saying, no, what we need are good public schools. We need good funding. And the way we're going to do that is by fighting against the corporate privatizers, whether it's Democrats or Republicans.
The other piece of this, Eric, is you interviewed 100 teachers for your book, Red State Revolt, and so many of these teachers had never been to a union meeting before, or they were checked out of politics, like, well, the 100 million people who don't vote in this country, because so many of them think it's pointless. But these strikes really showed them that people power makes a huge difference. And in so many examples, you can actually win and you can get your demands met.
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately the biggest significance of this movement right now might go beyond education. And that is that it's brought the strike as a particular type of tactic mm-hmm. and weapon back to the table. And that's really important and significant because, unfortunately, the labor movement has, for the most part, dropped the strike weapon for the last four decades, instead just trying to lobby the Democratic Party, doing some things that were fine. You know, rallies and protests are good. But the reality is that in order to beat back the real corporate offensive against working people generally and unions and teachers and education in particular. It's just the other tactics haven't worked. And I think ultimately that's why we're seeing this wave of strikes right now, because everything else has been tried. Trying to elect Democrats has been tried. Obama responds by pushing through more charters than any administration before or since. Mm-hmm. And so the strike was seen to work in West Virginia, right? The sense of powerlessness that people normally have, right? That's the main obstacle we face. It's not that people don't realize things are bad, but just they don't think anything can be done about it.
Right.
But then when West Virginia happened, it captured people's imagination across the country, and teachers overwhelmingly said, well, if they're doing it there, why can't we do it here?
Erica, we have to let you go in just a couple minutes, so I have two more questions from you, for you. Eric brought up the fact that this has really also empowered students. And watching the video out of LA, it was amazing to see the students speaking right next to the teachers and other educators in the school. We should say the bus drivers went on strike, the janitors went on strike. What have you heard from students? What did you hear after these strikes, and especially in light of the changes that you've seen in the classroom?
It's definitely a lesson in civics, right? It's a lesson in lobbying power. It's a lesson in what people power looks like and what this labor movement looks like. So I speak to these things naturally in my class. I've designed like a whole social justice curriculum, and I've married it to English and history, and I teach 11th grade. And so talking about those things and seeing those things and seeing the models is one thing, enacting it is another. And so for me, it was just like an extension of what we have already done in the class and what a lot of Los Angeles teachers are now called to do in their classrooms, right, is to engage students in these like very necessary conversations and then to take away some of the fear that's surrounding all of these things and under this, or well, all the issues that we're facing in, as people of color in these communities as a result of this regime. So for me, it's the most powerful thing, because I teach brown and black children, and they came out and they joined us, and then they went home and they took that knowledge back home. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, we're demystifying the strike, we're demystifying the labor union, but more so, we're demystifying political participation from parents and students in these conversations around educational policy. So I think that it was the most powerful thing that came out of the strike, at least for me as a teacher and as an educator, as a mom with a child in LAUSD public schools. I thought that that was the most important thing that we could do, and that was the biggest thing that, like, you know, educators fight with. You know, we want to engage parents, and we just never really thought about the strike until it happened, and then it just made sense, and then it was just natural. So I just so that you know, I went on ahead and I designed an app for LA, like in specific. The app goes on ahead and talks to our parents and our students. It's free and it's on the App Store. It's called Welga LA Activist. And what it does is it demystifies these things. I mean, we're talking about letting parent or fighting for parents to go on ahead and like vote in for their school board members, regardless of like immigration status. And we're not dealing with the fear that surrounds these new actions and these new words and these new experiences. But the strike was really the beginning of that conversation. Now I can talk to parents and I can say, hey, this is a continuation of the strike. This is what we're fighting for. I need you at this meeting, you know, or I need you to go on ahead and write postcards for this candidate because they're pro public school and this is important. And they get it. They trust it. They know what we're doing.
And I'm looking at your app page right now. It says, children need champions. Get involved, speak out, volunteer, give every child a fair chance to succeed. And we'll put a link to this app on our website. So if you know anyone in the LA area, you can spread the word about Erica Alvarez's app. I know we have to let you go, Erica. Thank you for joining us. Thanks for your great work. And I know that you're getting ready to go back to school, but we'd love to have you back maybe during your next break.
Of course, I'd be delighted to. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you so much. That is Erica Alvarez. She's a Latinx activist and English and language arts teacher at Legacy Visual and Performing Arts High School in Southgate, California, in Los Angeles. She was just telling us about the demands that have been met, smaller class sizes, more nurses. They're still fighting for a psychiatric counselor to be on campus at all times. They went on strike in LA for a record 6 days. 98% of LA teachers voted in favor of that strike. Coming up after a short break, we will continue speaking with Eric Blanc, a former high school teacher in the Bay Area, who now is an on-the-ground correspondent for Jacobin magazine. He's author of Red State Revolt, The Teacher's Strike Wave and Working Class Politics. And we'll be joined by Joseph Glatzer. He teaches seventh grade at Pinole Middle School in the West Contra Costa Unified School District. Today, we're talking about the teacher strike wave, where it's at today and where it's going and what it means for the larger labor movement. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
You are listening to Your Call on KALW, local public radio. To take part in today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, toll free. Let us know if you're a first-time caller. We always like to hear from new voices. If you'd prefer to write rather than call, you may email yourcall@kalw.org or leave a comment on the website at yourcallradio.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. 1A will be talking about the Democratic candidates' debates for the last couple of days, coming up at 11 o'clock this morning, just a half an hour from now, right after Your Call, here on 91.7 KLW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We will speak with award-winning journalist Lawrence Lanahan about his new book, The Lines Between Us, Two Families and a Quest to Cross Baltimore's Racial Divide. I should say that we did book this show long before Donald Trump's racist Twitter rant about Baltimore. What are your thoughts about media coverage of this? Are the media doing a good job of really educating people about the racist policies in Baltimore, especially when it comes to housing? That is tomorrow. And then on Monday on our One Planet series, we'll talk about why so many marine mammals are dying and getting sick in California. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea or feedback for us, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. And if you'd like to join today's show about the massive educators strike that we saw across the country last year, where it is today and where it's going, we'd love to hear from you. If you're an educator, if you have children in school, or if you just care about public education, what are your thoughts on these strikes? 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. And then the bigger question, what about the connections to the labor movement? We have a question from Virginia. She says, I am hopeful, especially with such lovely new leaders like the educators on your program, Go Teachers. One of our most challenging issues is retaining teachers. We've lost a lot of the public's respect, and thus only the most resilient new folks stay in the field. What are your thoughts about this, Joseph? I have so many friends who got into teaching and they just got burned out and they left, which is just really sad. What's your experience been like?
Yeah, I think you're right about that. I think there's a statistic, I don't know it off the top of my head, but many teachers leave within their first few years. Yeah, I think there's a few factors, and I think it's more accurately described as teacher demoralization rather than teacher burnout. And there's a few issues involved with that. First of all, class size. So like I said, at my school, we're going down next year to 37, but this is nowhere near what's reasonable to do, really what our students deserve. And so from my perspective, the only way to deal with that is from the state, because the state doesn't fund education enough, and so they really need to supplement that funding on that. Salary is another issue. I think, especially here in the Bay Area and most of the big cities in California, you know, we're going all the way from San Diego, Los Angeles, Orange County, you know, San Francisco, the East Bay. There are so few places where you can afford to be a teacher and make a decent salary and actually be able to buy a home. Frankly, most of the teachers I know that own homes bought them a long time ago when they were still, you know, relatively cheap and more affordable. And maybe there's a few who bought them right after the crisis in, you know, 2008, 2009, and the prices were really low. But other than that, for teachers like me who have only been teaching a few years and those just starting out and who are living in California, we don't have much hope that we're ever going to be able to buy a house. Mm. You know, the best hope we can ever have is just somehow getting an apartment where the landlord doesn't raise the rent too much every year. And that brings us to another issue which is connected, which is, you know, rent control. Unfortunately, the proposition was voted down in the last election, but we need strict rent control in this state. We need all these other policies to sort of help support teachers and the working class in general. And then the final issue that I'll kind of highlight is, you know, the need for actual restorative justice and, you know, effective behavior management and classroom management techniques in the schools. And so one of the things that the charter schools have done is sort of take advantage of some of the chaos in public schools. And that's due to things like kids who face a lot of trauma, who act out because of that, who have difficult home lives. And we just don't have the resources to help these kids the way they need to be helped. And so when they do go ahead and act out to seek that attention, you know, we don't have much of a choice but to send them out of the classroom or, you know, send them to the school psychologist if one is available. But a lot of schools don't even have that kind of psychology resources available. And so as the state has made this push to cut suspensions, which I think is the morally just thing to do, they haven't funded the alternative. And I think that's a big problem facing our schools. And so we need billions of dollars to supplement local funding for these kinds of mental health services and just behavioral specialists and people who can help us deal with these issues. And like I mentioned, a smaller class size would also make these issues easier to deal with. And just to circle back, charter schools are sort of an authoritarian response to these issues that we face in the schools, because they go way too far in the other direction in a lot of times on really harsh authoritarian discipline. And parents in general want their kids to go to a school that's well-run and well-managed, and teachers want to teach in a school where they feel like they can teach and they don't have one or two kids that are sort of making it difficult to teach the rest of the class. And so, like I said, I have sympathy for those students, and we need to support them, not kick them out of school. But at the same time, we just don't have those funds.
To that point, Joseph, how hard is it? I mean, you just said that the class size came down to 37 at your school, Pinole Middle School, in the West Contra Costa Unified School District. I understand that last year, in three of your classes, you had 38 students.
Yeah, that's right. One class was 38, one was 37, and then the rest were like in the mid or low 30s, or I think I had one in the upper 20s.
And are you the only teacher in the classroom?
Yeah.
Wow.
We have like one special ed aide who comes to different classes, but she's spread throughout the entire school. And so that's another thing we need a lot more of is support staff.
So when you have kids who have difficult home lives or come to class hungry, mm-hmm. how do you deal with that with 38? Well, now you're going down to 37, but how do you deal with that with 38, 37 kids?
You know what? I think teachers work miracles every day, and I'm not saying I'm something special that I do it, but we just always have to find a way. You know, we make it work. We support our students in the best way we can. You know, I make a big focus on building relationships with my students. I think it's really important that they see us as human beings, as regular people, and not just teachers, not some kind of overlord, you know, over them, not as like an authority figure like their parents that they just want to rebel against. I try to make myself not necessarily as a friend, but just to show them my real personality, to learn more about myself. I try to learn more about them. And just kind of build connections in other cases to try to build those connections. I do have kids who sometimes ask me, can I have money for lunch? You know, can I have a dollar to buy a bag of chips or something? And, you know, if I have it, I give it. And, you know, it's pretty much all we can do is do our best under very difficult circumstances.
Joseph, do you ever think, and what do you think of this idea? I have a friend who was working in the public school system, and she was totally demoralized, and she got a higher paying job at a private school. And she said, I felt so guilty about it, but I didn't want to leave education. I just couldn't continue. And there are two teachers for every small classroom. She said it makes a world of difference.
Yeah, I can imagine. And one of those things you look at is when we say that we have a problem with education in America, no, actually, I think we have more of a problem with poverty. Mm-hmm. We have more of a problem with, you know, institutional racism, corporate power, unaccountable corporations, like I mentioned. And we don't tax millionaires and billionaires. And so other countries that have really good results that you look at, we can compare right up with them when you look at our middle class and upper class public schools, and they have some of those resources you're talking about even in the public system. And we do have a two-tiered system where the private schools are able to offer things that we can't even hope to offer, and those are kids who also have a lot of advantages already. So yeah, I can understand a teacher's perspective of wanting to do that, but for me, I don't think it's something I would do, even though I can understand that kind of impulse to actually want to be able to teach and not have to worry about all those other things. But at the same time, we're in society, and we can't run away from society's problems, even if they're difficult. And I think people who aren't involved in frontline services, like if you're a nurse, like if you're a public school teacher, you know, I don't think people are aware of the issues we're dealing with in society. They don't realize how bad it is.
Well, and I just want to add, since you brought up taxes, we were watching the debates over the last couple nights, and I shared this fact with some friends. Of the 35 richest countries in the world, the United States ranks 32nd in total tax burden. Mexico and Chile pay fewer taxes than the United States, but other OECD countries pay more. And I just think that's a really important fact to highlight. Eric, what about the issues Joseph is bringing up? What did you hear from other teachers across the country about the fact that this is about really political will, taxing corporations, taxing the wealthy in order to actually pay for what these schools need?
Yeah, I think that's in some ways crucial. Really what the strikes did across the board is they challenged the scarcity narrative, this narrative that there's just not enough to go around, right? Because that's what we hear every single time we ask for anything, even something really modest. Just there's never enough funds, there's just not enough money. And the politicians make it seem like this is just a scarcity issue, right? Hopefully sometime next year down the road, we'll have more funds to give what you need. But in the meantime, there's nothing we can do, our hands are tied. That's the argument. And so what's so powerful about these strikes is it called BS on that. It said, no, you're lying. That's not true. There's more than enough money in every single one of our states to provide an excellent public education for every single student in the state. And the reason that hasn't happened is because for decades, politicians, both Democrats and Republicans, have been giving tax breaks to the rich and the corporations. So, you know, the public coffer has been bled dry, right? And that message really resonates with people. Because it's true. In California, for instance, if we were just to go back to the funding mechanisms that we had before Prop 13, which was passed in 1978 and which has really dramatically cut the public funding for schools, you'd be able to provide more than enough to meet all of the demands of the strikers in the recent period. And so it's a question of political will. Unfortunately, the politicians overwhelmingly remain beholden to corporate interests, so they don't want to take the necessary steps. Now they're pretending like they side with us, which is good. You know, for the most part, we want them to side with us, but we haven't seen the dramatic action necessary. And it's going to be a real test to see whether, in a place like California, where you have a supermajority of Democrats, why is it still such a battle to get basic funding for schools? Why is it such a battle to get just a moratorium on charter schools? It really raises the question about, you know, what it's going to take to force the politicians to really meet the demands of folks. And I would say that the most exciting aspect of the strikes is that insofar as it's won this argument and it's winning this argument around funding, it's raising the expectations of working people generally. Because if, you know, what the other side tries to do is lower our expectations, tell us we don't deserve anything. But now people are like, well, yeah, we deserve great public schools. And if we're able to win these schools, that type of logic can spread. If we can win, if there's more than enough money for schools, why isn't there enough money for Medicare for All? Why isn't there enough money for Green New Deal? Why isn't there enough money to dismantle the prison industrial complex? So the logic of the teacher strikes really is potentially very explosive because it challenges the whole prioritization of corporate profits over just basic human needs.
Well, we have a question about Prop 13. Let's hear from Ruth Ann in El Cerrito. Hi, Ruth Ann. Welcome to the show.
Moments ago, but that is a solution to this conundrum. If Prop 13 was repealed, would that make a difference?
Well, we're going to be able to vote on that. Prop 13, the split roll Prop 13, has already qualified for the November 2020 ballot. And according to the Chronicle, the California Democratic Party backs the idea and 54% of likely voters so far, although it hasn't really gotten that much attention yet because we're still a ways away from that. But what are your thoughts on that, Eric? You used to teach in the Bay Area. What about this ballot initiative, Prop 13, and how it would change school funding?
Yeah, I think this is going to be an epic battle, right? Prop 13, if we're able to reform it as the schools and communities first initiative, which is now on the ballot in 2020, if this passes, it's going to be a game changer for California. We're talking about billions and billions of dollars that would be put into the schools and to public services. But, you know, I think it would be a real mistake to underestimate how hard the corporations are going to go to defeat this. We saw this even in LA, where a modest increase in property taxes was just subjected to a real scare campaign from the powers that be in LA, because they understand what's at stake here. What's at stake here is taking back a huge amount of wealth that they've been taken from us for a long time. So the exciting thing is UTLA, which is the teachers union in Los Angeles, has partnered with unions and community organizations across the state to make this ballot initiative really a priority campaign. And I think that what we're about to see in California is the first statewide movement for public education funding that could win a real dramatic increase in a very long time. So I think it's for folks who are listening and want to get involved, I would definitely think this is a great way to plug in. It's going to be an epic battle. We need sort of all hands on deck to win.
And for people who live outside of the area, just to let you know, so Prop 13 rolled back assessments for homes and businesses to 1976 levels and capped annual tax increases at 2%. And politicians have been just frightened to touch this since then. So they decided to basically do a split roll. It's not going to affect homeowners, but it would affect corporations. And according to the Chronicle, some California businesses are paying property taxes based on assessments that have not changed in 40 years. So you have a lot of tech companies that whose property taxes are what they paid back in the 70s. And this measure could raise up to $11 billion annually for schools and the local government. What are your thoughts about this, Joseph? I mean, as Eric said, this would be a game changer.
Yeah, I think it would be. It would be a big victory for public education in terms of the increased funding we would get. I don't know the exact figures, but I think it would be spread by, it would be given by county, and then the county would be able to spread it among the schools. So I'm not exactly sure how much money we would get, but I'm sure it would be very helpful with our budget situation. On the other hand, the other issue here is, it is insufficient. Even if this passes, it's a drop in the bucket compared to what we really need to spend in California. And so it's also a little difficult to implement in some ways, because you can challenge these reassessments in court, and this can be held up in appeals for years potentially. And so I'm sort of wondering if it would be easier, not politically probably, but just feasibly, to just raise taxes on millionaires and billionaires, because actually that's what you're going to need to do in addition to this. Taxing corporations isn't going to be enough. We should also be eliminating corporate loopholes, which are a sizable portion of the California budget as well. We should have an oil depletion tax. We should have a wealth tax. You know, so those are the other things that we should be doing. I'm not going to downplay this and say it's not important, but it's insufficient. And the other thing I would mention is the charter schools get a big piece of this money. So by law, they get a piece of any new increase in education funding, including parcel tax increases by local districts. And so that's going to also increase privatization. And so although it's going to help us, it's also going to help the people that are trying to also destroy public education at the same time.
And since really money is one of the crucial issues here, one more fact about taxes, which I wish that these candidates would mention. 50 years ago, for every dollar the federal government raised by taxing us, it raised $1.50 by corporations. So 50 years ago, for every dollar we paid, corporations paid $1.50. Today, for every dollar we pay, corporations pay 25 cents. Mm-hmm. So the last 50 years has seen such a shift from taxes away from businesses onto all of us. But that just doesn't get mentioned very much.
No, it doesn't. And this is just the increase in corporate power in this country. And this has been done, like we were talking about, under both Republicans and Democrats. When you look at the leadership of California, you know, Governor Jerry Brown did a few good things for education, but primarily he didn't want to do anything on, you know, raising taxes on the millionaires and billionaires. He didn't want to take on charter schools, even very modest reform efforts, extremely modest. He vetoed those. And so now we have Governor Newsom, and we're wondering, what is he really going to do? They have a super majority. They could do anything they want. But in practice, in California, we have a one-party state. You know, many people that would otherwise be running as Republicans, whose ideology is basically of a moderate Republican, are running as Democrats because they know they can't win as a Republican in California in most cases. And so the Republican Party itself has become so incredibly extreme, so racist, and so xenophobic and everything else, that those people that are sort of like, okay, I'm socially liberal, I want gay rights, I want abortion rights, I want, you know, equal rights for women and so on, but we don't want to touch the millionaires, we don't want to touch the billionaires, we don't want to take on the real estate industry. I think a lot of the Democratic Party in California is that type of Democrat.
Can you also give us an update, Joseph, about school closures in California?
Yeah, so I think Oakland, for example, was looking to close one-third of their schools, and a lot of the schools that have already been closed by Oakland were handed over to charter schools, and people are afraid that these new school closures will be also handed over to charter schools. There was a very special and interesting school in East Oakland called Roots Academy, I think, and they were doing a lot of programs for Black and Latino youth, and, you know, they were shut down despite massive protests by the community. And in my district, we are facing up to a $30 million budget shortfall for next year. And so how are they going to close that? Especially when you have charter schools in our district wanting to take more and more space due to Prop 39, it creates a lot of problems. And one of the only ways you can cut these budgets, which local districts are forced to do, because like I said, they don't get enough money from the state, they can either lay off teachers, cut other services, or close schools. But actually, in the long run, if you look at the study, school closures hurt school district budgets more because they will oftentimes become charter schools, which then take more funding. So it's like you're shutting down a school that your students can go to so that other students can go there that aren't even necessarily a part of your district, yet you're still paying for it. So this is kind of the worst of both worlds.
That is Joseph Glatzer. He teaches 7th grade history at Pinole Middle School and the West Contra Costa Unified School District in Northern California. Eric Blanc is a former high school teacher in the Bay Area and author of Red State Revolt, The Teacher's Strike Wave and Working Class Politics. Eric, you explore so many things in your book, and one important thing you explore is that in so many of these so-called red states, the polling shows, and this polling is often ignored, especially when the media talks about Trump supporters, that most people in these states want higher taxes on the wealthy to pay for public services, that they support more investment in public education. And a lot of them say that if they could, they would join a union.
Yeah, this idea that the big divide in our country is between red states and blue states is really superficial at best, and the strike wave has challenged that directly.
Yeah.
If you think about it, take a step back. It's amazing that the bulk of the strikes that have happened have taken place not in liberal bastions, but amongst large swaths of people who would have been dismissed by a lot of the, you know, media elite as brainwashed Trump supporters. But in fact, what you had in all states, but including in red states, is you have a working class that, you know, for the most part is disaffected and feels that the status quo is not really meeting their demands. And so it's very tricky. If you look at a place like West Virginia, people consider West Virginia a red state, but that's because the Democratic Party ran the state for 80 years up until just 2014, implemented tax break after tax break. So it's understandable in a place like that, people just check out of politics, and then some of them will vote for Trump if they think Trump is promising change. And so what the polls show, and that what the strikes show, and I would say also now the, you know, interest and support for Bernie Sanders really all across the country, it shows that there's a huge amount of people who are looking for a political alternative to the status quo. And so when it comes to across the board, funding for schools, Medicare for all, cleaning up our environment, including on social issues like rights for immigrants, you have an already existing progressive majority. The problem is that the Democrats pretend like the problem in the United States is that people are too far to the center, so they have to appeal to the center. to win. But in fact, the reason that they don't want to implement these bold demands is not because it's not winnable, but it's because that would go against the corporations that are funding their campaigns. So I think that the strikes, just like the Bernie Sanders campaign, are really showing that a progressive working class majority exists. The question is, how do we organize it?
And you also mentioned that it's important to remind everyone that Bernie won every county in West Virginia in the last primary.
Yeah, people think that West Virginia is just Trump land. As you mentioned, Bernie won every single county. And again, we see Bernie's campaign is having a tremendous resonance with a lot of these red state strikers and strikers in a place like Los Angeles, because unfortunately most of the politicians, including in the Democratic Party, have been pushing charter schools and privatization for a long time. So it's really amazing that we're in a moment now where you have somebody on a national stage calling for a moratorium on charters, rights for teachers, and being out there on the picket line supporting teachers when they fight back, encouraging other workers to fight back as well. It's really, yeah, it's a remarkable moment in U.S. history.
And final thoughts from both of you. Where do you see this going? I just printed out a piece from Education Dive, and it says, as the school year approaches, some districts are still in contract negotiations. Teachers unions in Chicago, Columbus, Ohio, and Clark County, Nevada say the possibility of a strike is still on the table. And this was just came out just a couple of days ago. And then another one from the Orlando Sentinel, Orange County teachers reject controversial contract by 4-1 margin. This is in Florida. So these pieces just came out in the last few days. Eric, where do you see this going?
Right. Well, we know that in Chicago, teachers are being prepared or preparing potentially to strike. And one of the exciting dynamics that we've seen all across the country is that militant rank-and-file teachers who have been inspired by the strikes across the country and have been organizing are starting to take back their unions. So in Baltimore, the rank-and-file caucus just won the leadership. Similarly, in Denver. And this poses the possibility now of the old guard and the unions, both on a local and hopefully on a national level, are getting pushed out by people who actually want to fight for their students, fight for themselves. And I think this kind of wave of taking back the unions and this wave to push to have the unions have a democratic process and who they endorse for the 2020 elections is going to really set the basis for a reinvigorated, longstanding, and lasting education movement.
And Joseph, we have about 30 seconds. Where do you see this going?
Well, I agree with everything Eric said, and I think, unfortunately, we're going to see more efforts for charter expansion, school closures, and layoffs. But, you know, we're not going to take it lying down. Teachers know the power we have now. And so we're going to fight these things, and we're going to take on our own union leadership if necessary, if they're not doing enough to fight back. And if necessary, also, you're going to see more wildcat strikes like there were in Oakland, and, you know, the whole state of West Virginia went on a wildcat strike.
Joseph Glatzer teaches 7th grade history at Pinole Middle School, where he is a union rep and a member of United Teachers of Richmond. Their class size just went down to 37 students. Last year, Joseph taught 38 students in 3 of his classes. Joseph, thank you so much for joining us, and we'd love to have you back.
Thank you so much. I'd love to do it again.
Eric Blanc is a former high school teacher in the Bay Area who now writes about labor movements and teacher strikes. He is a correspondent for Jacobin Magazine and author of the book Red State Revolt, The Teacher Strike Wave and Working Class Politics. Eric, thank you for joining us. And coming up tomorrow, we will be joined by award-winning journalist Lawrence Lanahan. We'll discuss his new book, The Lines Between Us, Two Families and a Quest to Cross Baltimore's Racial Divide. We did book Lawrence long before Donald Trump's lengthy racist Twitter rant about Baltimore. I hope you can join us for that. Thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show and also doing social media. Thanks to Kevin Vance, our studio engineer, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.